In the spring, a young man's fancy gently turns to shoveling snow. Where else but in Cleveland could spring fever be a case of acute subnormal temperatures? But in spring, even if it is only an artificial creation of the calendar, in spring a young man's fancy does gently turn to thoughts of love, and if he is a literate young man, he turns again to those magnificent pages of our Bible which include the Song of Songs, where there he will find one of the most magnificent apostrophes in all poetry to that spring surging of life and of love. Hark, my beloved. Behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping over the hills. My beloved is like a stag or a young hart. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He looks in through the window. He peers through the lattices. My beloved spoke and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing is at hand. The voice of the turtle dove is heard again in our land. The fig trees put forth their green figs. The vines blossom and give forth their fragrance. Rise, my love, my fair one, and come away. You can search all of world literature. You will not find any more sensitive, imaginative, or beautiful description of the change of cold to warmth, of life to surging vitality, as these lines from our Song of Songs. And you can turn over the pages of our Hebrew literature. And I think you will be surprised at how involved in, how sensitive to our forefathers were to the changes of seasons. They responded instinctively to nature. A rabbi of 2,000 years ago, Rabbi Judah, advised his fellow Jews in the springtime when they see the greenness at the top of the trees begin to turn here and there in the breeze, to pause and to utter a prayer. Praised be thou, O Lord our God, who has fashioned a world so harmonious in all of its parts, who allows man's heart to be delighted with all manner of living things and with the beauty of the forms of trees and of plants. Our forefathers responded as we do, as it is human, instinctive, and natural to do. Our forefathers responded to the change of the seasons, and they responded especially to this, perhaps the most beautiful of all the seasons, certainly the most hopeful, hope-filled of all the seasons, to the season of spring. We will observe this week the holiday of Passover. Passover, of course, commemorates the great first deliverance of our Jewish people from Egyptian bondage. But woven into the rich tapestry of the Passover is a spring holiday, a natural holiday. Passover was the time which marked off the beginning of the spring harvest. It must have been in most ancient Israel a warm, happy occasion, this pilgrimage of the Judean farmer to the Jerusalem temple. The air was clear and brilliant. The landscape shone with a newness and richness of color. Still today, the Passover season remains perhaps the most appropriate of all times to visit the Holy Land. And they came to Jerusalem and offered there on the heights of the temple their sacrifices. And then they sat down in the coolness of a spring evening to eat of the paschal dinner, of the Seder. Their hearts, their whole physical being must have rejoiced to participate in the joy of deliverance and the joy of spring. And at this earliest of Seders, or in their temples and synagogues on the next day during the worship service, our ancestors turned to this Shir HaShirim, the book of the Song of Songs, and they read there this magnificent and fitting description of spring. Now, many have said that the combination of themes dealing with spring in the Passover service and in the Song of Songs explains the interconnection of this book with the Passover holiday. For from that day to this, our people have read the Song of Songs during the Passover season. I should like to suggest to you this morning that this interconnection of spring motifs is not a reason sufficient for the establishment of this religious custom. I should like to suggest to you this morning a more significant religious reason, one which will come out of our discussion of this most magnificent and moving of biblical books. What is the Song of Songs? It is a slender volume, 8 chapters in all. Were you to add up the verses, you would find that they include only 117 lines of poetry. That is the sum and substance the Book of Song and Songs. And with what does this poetry deal? It deals with the many voices of love. There is no development in its thought. There is no philosophy implicit in its literal meaning. It is simply a poetic turning about of a single theme: man's love. Man's love for his sweetheart and her love for him. And to read the Song of Songs is to be deeply moved, for this is poetry of a most high order, rich in imagery and rich in imagination. And even if sometimes we must pause and are a bit perplexed at the nature of some chosen Oriental symbolism, even if we are not accustomed to describing our sweethearts as if their eyes have the sympathy of the dove or their cheeks the ripe redness of the pomegranate, or if their hair is as black as the curling trail of the sheep down the mountainside, if we find it archaic and somewhat picturesque to draw the descriptions of our loved ones from the world of nature, should we not humbly pause and wonder what another generation will think of our descriptions, our modern descriptions of our loved ones? For it is a strange reflection in our materialistic society that we describe beauty in terms of the costliest of gems. The hair of our beloved is as spun gold. The eyes of our beloved sparkle as diamonds or emeralds. The teeth of our beloved are pearly white. Her lips are ruby red. It is as if we can find no other form of praise than cost and wealth. And some other generation will surely pass judgment on us for such imagery and such imagination. Read through the Song of Songs and you will be both pleased and puzzled. You'll be pleased at the brilliance of the poetry, at its depth of feeling, at the richness of its symbols, at the appropriateness of its language. Where else would you find such a magnificent admission of love as this? Set me a seal upon thy heart. Set me as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The flashes thereof are flashes of fire, a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Mighty waters cannot drown love. If a man would give all of his substance for love, he would be utterly scorned. Love cannot be bought. Love is a rich gift of God. Where else has this been more appropriately said? But I have said that were you to read the Song of Songs again, you would be puzzled. And you would be puzzled by this simple question. Why is this rich, sensitive love poetry included in our Bible? It preaches no moral. It does not redound to the praise of God. It does not reflect on any significant event in our Jewish tradition. It is not in the common use of the word religious at all. Why is it included in our Bible? Now, there are some who answer that the Bible is, after all, no more than a compendium, an anthology of all Hebrew literary output from the time of Moses, say, to the time of the Maccabees. That is, from about 1250 before the Common Era to about 200 or 150 before the Common Era. That it is a collection of all Jewish belles lettres without any judgment of its contents. And hence, we ought not to be surprised at the inclusion of love poetry, for that is natural poetry in the Bible. But this, my friends, is emphatically not the case. We know of contemporaneous literature from this ancient period, which was specifically excluded from the Bible. And we have records of the great rabbinic debates in the first and second century of the Common Era, in which they argued whether certain of the books of the Bible should be included or excised from the canon. Materials are in the Bible because they are holy, because they deal with the question of man's place in God's world, because they deal with religious issues. And however brilliant the philosophy, however correct the history, however full of insight the psychology of some other works, if it was not felt by these ancient rabbis that these were holy books, that they dealt with spiritual matters, they were excluded from the Bible. And if you would see the literary merit of these excluded books, I would ask you only to pick up the Apocrypha, the so-called hidden books, and read this great literature. So we cannot explain the inclusion of the Song of Songs in the Bible by claiming the Bible to be simply a secular anthology of Jewish literature. Now, another school of thought has it that the Song of Songs is included in the Bible out of respect for and veneration of King Solomon. The superscription with which this book begins, a line added obviously by some later author, says this. This is the Song of Songs which is Solomon's, or this is the best of the songs which were written by Solomon. Solomon is referred to 7 times in the text of the Song of Songs, although never as its author, except in this later superscription. And this tradition has it that this man, the symbol of Jewish royalty, the wisest of Jewish kings, Solomon, who is referred to elsewhere in the Bible as the author of 105 songs, that it was out of veneration and respect for his person that the Song of Songs was included in the Bible despite its secular, sensual content. But again, I would advise you that there were circulating in ancient Israel at the time when the Bible was canonized another set of songs attributed to King Solomon, the so-called Psalms of Solomon, which were specifically not included in the Bible. And so neither the argument of literary merit nor the purported authorship by a royal prototype, nor the veneration of some ancient beloved literature is sufficient to explain the inclusion of the Song of Songs as biblical literature. How then can we explain it? We must turn for an explanation to the debates which raged in the first and second century over the canonization, the final editing of the Bible. And if we look carefully at these debates, we will find that it was Rabbi Akiba, probably the most brilliant, certainly the most pious, manifestly the most respected of early rabbinic sages, who fought for and who won for the Book of the Song of Songs inclusion in the Bible. And if we listen to his arguments, we will find a strange but recurring theme. For in the debate at Yavne, the first of the great debates over the inclusion of the Song of Songs, Akiba is reported to have said this: "He who reads the Song of Songs as if it is secular, as if it is love poetry only, has no place in the world to come." Now, what did he mean? He meant that the Song of Songs is esoteric literature, that it is a secret code, verse which includes a deeper hidden meaning, and that when one has the key to this deeper meaning, one then can understand a higher truth. Now, what was this higher truth which the Song of Songs contained? This we do not know for certain. The literature of mysticism seldom leaves to future generation its key. But I would like to place before you this morning one historical reconstruction, one which I believe is both new and novel, and yet one which is historically plausible and, if true, would explain both the veneration of the Song of Songs, its inclusion in the Bible, and its inclusion as part of the Passover liturgy. I would take you back for an explanation to the days of Rabbi Akiba. I would remind you that he was born in the year 40 or thereabouts of this era, and that he died in the year 135 of this era. I would remind you that the cardinal political issue of Akiba's day was Israel's relations with Rome. Rome ruled Israel, and often misruled Israel. And while Akiba was yet a young, illiterate peasant lad, the Jews rose up in the year 66 and in the year 68 in rebellion against Rome. The rebellion was futile as it was brave and courageous, and as a result of that rebellion, the countryside was destroyed and set on fire, the population was decimated, and most damaging of all, the sanctuary, the temple itself, was destroyed. Israel was utterly subjected to the Roman heel. There was no hope. But hopes and dreams and prayers do not die easily. And the Jews continued to pray for God's vengeance against their oppressor. They continued to hope for the Messiah who would be the harbinger of better times. They continued to pray fervently for the reestablishment of the symbol of their religious life, the temple in Jerusalem. And Akiba was of the party who dreamt and who hoped and who prayed. In the year 132, when Akiba was already a nonagenarian, he became the spiritual mentor of the second revolt against Rome. He announced a certain Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah. Jews rose up all over the countryside in arms. The city of Jerusalem was itself recaptured for a year. But of course, this revolt too was dashed by superior Roman might, and Akiba died a martyr to its cause. But Akiba was of the school then that dreamt and prayed for the reestablishment of the temple and of Jewish freedom. Now, it is my contention that the Song of Songs was looked upon by Akiba and by his followers as a text of prophecy, as a text which prophesied God's vengeance against Rome, God's permission to the Jews to reestablish in Jerusalem the temple. By Akiba's time, the Song of Songs was already a literature hoary with age. It is a literature of the Jewish antiquity. Probably the Song of Songs was originally a collection of love poems sung at the complicated and long Oriental wedding feasts. Poems of describing the beauty of the bride, the steadfastness of the bridegroom, and the love which they would share together. And these poems had been passed on by village bards from generation to generation. Favorite lines from other love poems were added from time to time. And included in the edition had been one of the love poems which had been commissioned by King Solomon at the time when he wedded one of his foreign princesses. This collection had been ascribed then by the people in their folk wisdom to King Solomon. And you must remember that it was King Solomon who had built the first temple in Jerusalem. He was the patron of the temple. And it was altogether natural that the people should turn to his writings to find hope and to find prophecy. And so Akiba and his followers turned to this poetry of love. And if you look not for its literal meaning, not for its heart poetry, but for its possible messianic prophecy, you will see that even the beautiful description of spring, which I read to you this morning, can be read as in terms of a longed-for, proximate, immediate coming of the Messiah and of God. For lo, the winter is past. The time of despair is about over. The rain is over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. There is reason to believe that God will right the ancient wrongs. The time of singing is come. The time of jubilation is about here. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The voice of the Messiah, the voice of hope, is heard again in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs. The vines are in blossom and give forth their fragrance. Arise, my love. Arise, my fair one, and come away. Reading the Song of Songs as prophecy, it is understandable why Akiba made what would otherwise be an extremely brash and rash statement. A genius scholar beyond description, he was not given to such statements. But he said during the debate over the inclusion of the Song of Songs, if all the books of the Bible, all the other books of the Bible are considered as holy, the Song of Songs is the Kadosh Kadoshim, the holiest of holies, the most sacred. Now, how could this slender volume of love poetry outweigh in his imagination the greatness of the legislation and the vision of the book of Deuteronomy, the brilliance of the prophetic utterances of an Isaiah or of a Jeremiah or of an Amos? Only if he found there proof text for his hope, proof text for God's undying love of Israel and God's sure promise of Israel's proximate redemption. And if this be so, we have an explanation of the conjoining of Passover in the Song of Songs. For precisely at this time in our history, the holiday of Passover took on a new dimension of significance. Until the temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era, the Passover was observed largely as a joyous, jubilant pilgrimage holiday on which the Jews expressed their delight in God's redemption of their ancestors from Egyptian slavery. But you will read, as I will read in our Haggadah tomorrow night, the prayer, next year, at this time, may all Israel be free. Once the chains of oppression were fettered to Israel's arms and legs again, the Passover became not only the rehearsal of some ancient deliverance, but a prayer and a statement of Israel's hope for some immediate new deliverance. Why do we break the afikoman? We say that we break the afikoman as a child's game to keep our little boys and girls awake until the end of the Passover service. And it is a fine game of hide and seek, although it occasionally costs the father a dollar or two. But that is not its original meaning. We broke the symbol of deliverance in two, and we ate half of it. Half had already been ours, and half we hid, for half was yet to come. And the second half was the certainty of its coming. And why do we open the door for Elijah? Certainly our wives and mothers have plenty of mouths to feed on Passover night. We open the door for Elijah because, according to our tradition, Elijah is the forerunner, the annunciator of the coming of the Messiah. We open the doors in the hope that he will come in and join us, and joining us will bring to us peace on earth and goodwill among men and the redemption of the Jewish people. And precisely after the year 70, this second dimension of significance, the hope for a redeemed Israel, a newly redeemed Israel, was woven into the tapestry of the Haggadah and of the Passover. And if you would have added proof of this, I would ask you only to visit our Temple Museum. And you will see there a magnificent cup of Elijah, but not shaped in the usual form of a goblet, but shaped rather in the form of a powerful stag. Now, why should a cup of Elijah assume the symbol of a large male deer? Here again we find the symbolism of the book of Song of Songs interpreted as meaning, as implying the sureness of Israel's deliverance. Let me turn again to this one set of verses dealing with spring with which I have dealt. Listen to its imagery. Hark, my beloved, behold, he comes. Leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills, my beloved is like a stag or a young hart. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He looks in through the windows. He peers through the lattices. My beloved spoke and said unto me, rise up, my love. Rise up, my fair one, and come away. What a beautiful reading of the Song of Songs. Elijah peering in at our windows, ready to enter our doors if we will only be prepared, only open our doors to him, and with his entry, symbolizing to Israel redemption and deliverance. Well, it is because the Song of Songs was interpreted in such an esoteric vein, was given this new dimension of significance, that it won inclusion in our Bible. But you and I, of course, cannot accept the interpretation of Akiba as the one originally intended by the authors of the Song of Songs. It is manifestly something which is read into the text and not implicit there. And yet, how can we deny the truth of what Akiba found there? For how can one rehearse the history of our people, look upon Jewish survival and not marvel at the constancy of God's love for Israel? How can we analyze our own situation today, surrounded by new Jewish vitality here and in Israel and throughout our world, immediately following the most decimating destruction ever faced by our Jewish people? My beloved is mine, and I am my beloved. For lo, the winter is past, and the rain is over and gone, and the time of singing is upon us. But if we cannot accept as the literal interpretation of the Song of Songs this meaning, and if we can accept the truth, however, of Akiba's statement, there is a truth implicit in the Song of Songs which can yet be ours. For what is the Song of Songs but an idealization of love? I do not mean lust. I mean love. I do not mean the bantering of personalities, but the ennobling of personalities. I do not mean falling in love, but building a marriage. Our Jewish tradition, the Song of Songs, idealizes love. Why? Because love is itself a form of deliverance from ourselves. Most people are afraid of love. They are afraid of its commitment. They are afraid of the hurt of and loss which love may cause them. If you do not love, you will never be hurt deeply. They are afraid of the sacrifices which love will demand of them. Sacrifices of self, sacrifices of time, sacrifices of energy, sacrifices of money, sacrifices of all kinds. Most people are afraid to open themselves up to love. Love of wife or husband, love of family, love of friends, love of country, love of one's people, and love of one's world. And yet the person who is constricted, tied in upon himself, incapable of feeling love, this person is only half a person. His emotions are cut off, cut short. He does not feel deeply. He does not live profoundly. Do we not need to be reminded time and again to allow ourselves to feel deeply, to feel the important surging emotions of life, to judge our relationships in life not by their cost, but by their potential? Do we not need to be delivered from ourselves? And is this deliverance of love not a great theme to be added to the great holiday of our political and social deliverance, the holiday of Passover? Hark, my beloved. Behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a stag or a young hart. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He looks in through the windows. He peers through the lattices. My beloved spoke and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing is come. The voice of the turtle dove again is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs. The vines are in blossom and give forth their fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Amen.